like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Welcome along to another Golf Weekly. It's a special Golf Weekly for you all, special friends of the pod, because we are broadcasting from Carton House, just outside Maynooth, County Kildare. Or to be more specific, we're here right in the heart of the GUI headquarters on site at Carton House, home, of course, to Manny and Irish Open. Fionn Davenport back with us. Hello, Fionn.
Hey, Joe.
Nathan Murphy here as well. Hello, Nathan.
How's it going?
Good. We are in what can only be described as a cloakroom in the GUI headquarters.
Well, mostly because it is a cloakroom.
It is a cloakroom. Well, is it a cloakroom? I thought this was all the gear they were just giving us that's hanging around the place.
No.
Brand new Under Armour gear.
Yes, Under Armour recently signed with the Irish team. It's a good signing. So the reason we're in the cloakroom is for sound reasons, as opposed to being ostracized from the people
here. No.
Is there anywhere out of sight we can put them? And so here is where we've ended up.
Is that a toilet behind us?
Yes, I think so. Open it.
It's locked.
It won't open.
No, this is a dressing room. It's a dressing room.
Oh, that's okay.
It's a dressing room. You're going to have to hold that mic a bit steadier, pal.
Sorry.
Bit muffled. There we go.
It's a dressing room.
You'll excuse any sound issues. We're doing our best here for you. So we've come all the way out to Carton House. It's a Wednesday morning. And naturally, Neil Manship, who's the national coach to the GUI, is around. So we're going to sit down and talk with him later on, which will be good. Pretty interesting fella. Came over to Ireland in 1992 and was an assistant pro at Royal County Down, and then went to Royal Dublin and has been here at the GUI for just over 10 years.
12.
Yeah, that is just over 10 years. Mm. Met Shane Lowry. And
20% more than 10 years.
That's true. They've had a remarkable relationship. And he's continuing to try and get some new players into the top 200, which we haven't had for a long time, as you were saying on the way over here.
Yeah, 2009. It seems strange. Yeah. We've had this generation coming through Walker Cups who are turning professional, but really are just struggling to make that final step up.
Yeah,
you would expect. I think Paul Dunne is going to do it in the next little while,
for sure.
So the show will potentially feature as well. We're not sure how the day is going to pan out, but Kenny Fahey is the GUI National Golf Academy head pro, and he's got some kind of TrackMan challenge for us later on. The results of which we hope never see the light of day.
Is there any way of breaking the TrackMan? I'm a bit worried.
But we may try and record some tips for him, actually, so that we can play those out over the next couple of weeks. Other big news then, before we get to Dustin Johnson's rise. Nathan Murphy and I will be recording a special feature tomorrow for Off the Ball, but it will go out in Golf Weekly. We are, Fionn, going to Padraig Harrington's house.
Ah, no. House.
Yeah.
Yeah. 10 a.m. Is that breakfast? Is it brunch?
He invited us for 10 a.m., so I can only imagine he's going to serve us some sort of food.
I'm genuinely envious of. When you get a chance, will you get him to take you out to his putting green out in the garden?
Oh, that's the whole point, I think, is to see the good stuff. Because he's got his own TrackMan in his wonderful room of golf, which has a billion clubs and kind of seems to have AstroTurf on the ground and all his bags and all his equipment. And I mean, it'll work wonderfully on radio.
Like, Padraig's only expecting us to come for 45 minutes, but we got a shock for him.
Years ago, a friend of mine, Peter Carroll, who is a decorative artist, was doing some work for Padraig's, like one of his children, just designing, like a bit of design in the room. And so Peter had one of his guys in with his young daughter. And at one point, Harrington walks in and goes, "Hey guys, how's it going?" And he goes, "Who's this the little girl that's out kind of chopping around in the putting green?" And he goes, "Oh my God, that's my, I'm so sorry. And Harrington was so calm, so easy, so relaxed. And in no way kind of going, "Listen, do you mind getting her off my really expensive putting green?"
Yeah.
And sure enough, the next thing, they look out the window. And it must be said that Peter and his friend know nothing about golf or care about golf, but they observe Harrington outside giving a little putting lesson to this little girl. It was a really lovely moment.
Putting lesson.
I mean, I really hope he does.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
It will be a sorry tale if we come back next week and say, no, it was 44 minutes and 55 seconds when he said, time to go. Yeah.
Sorry, lads.
Yeah, so we'll see. I mean, I feel like we're not worthy. I said that to you in the email.
Well, you specifically said, "I'm not worthy."
I said mainly you, but I feel like we're not worthy. I don't feel like Padraig Harrington should have to stoop to showing Nathan and I around his house for a radio feature, but I'm damn glad he's doing it.
MTV Cribs. We'll
somehow have to make the best of this.
It's Cribs in the radio. Are we bringing a camera?
No, we're not.
You're kidding. Who in News Talk didn't think that would be a good idea?
No, they don't want a camera. It's for a radio piece.
Oh, Harrington doesn't.
Well, they just don't want... It was set up as a radio piece, so they wanted to be a radio piece.
Okay.
And this, listeners, is what a production meeting sounds like.
But News Talk would have given us a camera if we
wanted. They would have. They would have.
Okay, fair enough. That's fine. Oh, that's a pity. Yeah. So it actually is going to be Cribs on the radio.
It is. So, yeah.
May not work, right?
Joe Malloy is descriptive best.
This here's a recreational area. Only 2 hours of TV per day.
Maybe we'll sit down on his couch. We'll watch back some Sky Sports highlights.
Yeah.
And we'll criticise Monty.
Yes.
And when he's doing commentary on the Masters, we'll go, don't do that.
Yeah. Harrington signed up for the Masters on Sky Sports.
Oh.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah. Learning an awful lot in this.
No, tune in. It'll be a hell of a feature.
Yeah.
We're in the bathroom. Yeah. It's just me and Nathan.
For sound reasons.
Forgot to turn off the recording device. Podrick has gone into the bathroom now.
He also has forgotten to turn off his recording device. Yeah, Harrington, it'd be exciting. Giddy they are. I'm just jealous.
Suddenly got giddy thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So there's that on the way. And also, final piece of housekeeping before we get to the tweets. Next Wednesday, there is an Off the Ball, and it is Golf Weekly, listeners, I stress, an Off the Ball golf day at Luttrellstown, the day before the Masters. Next Wednesday, we're going to be playing across the day, and we're doing the Off the Ball show live from Luttrellstown Clubhouse that evening. But, Nathan, we have secured some places specifically for Friends of the Pod.
Yes, we have secured 16 places.
That's 1-6.
1-6.
That's good.
So we're going to give away...
It's half our listenership.
Well, once upon a time.
Yeah.
Once upon a time. So we'll give away 8 people and they can all bring a friend. So it's a 1 o'clock shotgun start, Luttrellstown. Going to have a bit of grub afterwards and then we're going to be doing the full Off the Ball show there that evening. It's not going to be all golf.
No.
But it'll be mainly around the Masters and we're going to have a... chunky enough Masters preview in there as well. And also, everybody who plays is going to have a chance of winning a 1 year's membership of Luttrellstown. And nice. They'll get a lesson from Peter Lawrie.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Have we locked in any guests yet?
Don't be getting ahead. We're going to Porter Carrington's house tomorrow. Don't worry about that. Can I read the sponsorship line? Luttrellstown Castle Golf Club, Ireland's best kept secret. Offering a premium golfing experience in a majestic countryside setting. Just 20 minutes from Dublin City Centre. You should all go play there.
We played there a while back. It was
it's a great course.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Really
it's
good.
It's a long course. It's tough for a very poor golfer like me.
That's why I enjoyed it. I came into my own.
Hubris, Joe. Hubris. It's a good. Greek
thing. A year's membership there as a potential prize is nice. So what do the Golf Weekly Massive need to do?
Great question.
Thanks.
Well, it is very simple to enter this competition. All you have to do is tweet us at Golf Weekly NT.
Mm-hmm.
Tweet Luttrellstown. At Luttrellstown GC.
For the older members of the Golf Weekly Massive, do that in the same tweet.
Yes.
You can tweet two people
different
at once.
Tweets.
Yeah. Don't do
one after the other.
So just write at Golf Weekly NT and at Luttrellstown GC.
GC Golf Club.
Yeah.
See what they've done there?
I do. And what do you want them to write?
Well, write your name and tell us who is running the show now at Luttrellstown Golf Club. Who is the main man? He's the director of golf.
Yeah.
I may have mentioned his name just a moment ago as being part of the prize.
Yeah, he's part of the prize. So rewind 30 or 40 seconds on your phone there if you want to get the answer and he might give you a lesson. So they have to just give us his name. He's running the show there and tweet the two of us and we'll pick our 16 who can all bring a friend. Wednesday.
8 who can all bring a friend.
Oh, sorry, 8. Oh, it's exclusive enough then. 8 who can bring a friend. Okay, that's Luttrellstown. That's next Wednesday. That'll be good. We'll all be playing there as well, so there'll be an off the ball and Golf Weekly element.
You coming, Fionn?
I will endeavour to be there, yes.
Excellent. Okay, so before we get to Neil Manship, and we've got to discuss Dustin Johnson in a moment as well, but tweets. In the last week, I've heard Fionn went to school with Pele's son and had an uncle on the board of Fiorentina Football Club. What a life, says Stuart Mulhall.
Well, what? Not my life, it's a life of my uncle and Pele's son. Well, you and McKenna did that big feature piece on Pele's son, also called Edson. And he, when I went to school in New York for a few years when I was a kid, and he was in my class in school, and he's a nice kid. Like, I didn't realize he would turn into be like a guy who got involved in cocaine dealing and all kinds.
Oh, did he?
He's in prison.
Oh.
Yeah, he went to prison.
Right. Was he good at football?
No. No, yeah. He grew up in America, so he didn't really care about football.
Callum Best.
A little bit, yeah. And
was it a very posh private school you were in?
It was.
Was Pele sending his son to the very best school in New York?
It was the UN school.
Oh, yeah.
My dad was working for the UN at the time.
Yeah,
but
those UN schools are good. And everyone comes out of those things with the same accent. You've managed to escape it.
Yeah.
Probably because you're a natural English speaker. Anyone who learns English and goes to those UN schools speak with that American cross European accent.
You're absolutely right. That's a good observation.
Makes them seem dead inside.
Pele came to the school to pick up his son a bunch of times, but this one particular time we were kicking a ball out the back. And I remember he's wearing a camel hair coat, like what must be a $2,000 suit and a really expensive pair of leather shoes. And it's Pele. But a lot of the kids would have been American and so wouldn't have been aware. I mean, he played for Cosmos, but they wouldn't have been aware that this is one of the giants of world football.
Yeah.
And so I remember being, oh my God. And he showed us how to take a penalty. I've told this story before, but what he did is he moved the ball, he sliced across it and hit it with the back of his heel so that his body went one way and the ball went the other way. But of course, it's Pele, so he can do it and nobody else was able to do it that well. And then the other story that was on...
I've never... The hitting it off the heel thing, I've never really
seen. Yeah, I think he was just showing kids. I don't think he was out training.
He wasn't doing it in matches.
No.
Wow.
No, but he just said, this is, you want to take a penalty? You want to fool the goalkeeper? This is how you do it. And he just went like this. And so his foot went that way and the ball went this way.
And he did this in his nice leather shoes.
In a really expensive pair of leather shoes and a long beige camel hair coat.
Wow, in New York.
In New York, yeah.
What age are you?
11, maybe.
Of all the absolute horseshit that you've said to me on golf courses over hours and hours.
And I haven't said that yet.
This is what I don't understand.
No, not
you
once.
You did An Irishman Abroad and you spoke... Like, this should have been your first story.
Yeah. I've literally been taught how to take penalties from Pele.
My...
How is it now we're only getting to this?
I thought...
Three weeks' time. Yeah, and I remember that time I was in California and Tiger came up and he was like, you're putting strokes
move
all
your
wrong.
Ball to the move the ball to the front of your foot.
And Tiger said, go away.
Yeah.
I don't need your advice.
Well, don't you, Tiger? Don't you? And then my great uncle was Italian. My mum's Italian. And he was on the board of Fiorentina for years. And when Socrates signed for Fiorentina in the mid-80s...
Mm-hmm. Famously spent time in Dublin.
Yes, that's right.
And you bored everybody with your Pele story.
Yeah, this better be good. You've set the bar high now. You should have started with Pele.
He went to live my uncle had a house and he rented. That's where Socrates lived for the year that he was in Fiorentina. Oh. Which must be said, for one of the great Brazilian footballers of his generation, was an absolute disaster of a year. It was awful. He was partying, he was smoking, he was drinking. He was enjoying the good life, like Dolce Vita.
He was always smoking.
But he, this is the story that I told before, but that he had been saying in the press that he was here to play, to win a championship with Fiorentina. I think they had Passarella and Daniel Bertoni were in this team at that time as well. So they were a pretty decent side. Maybe not Juventus or what Milan would be within a couple of years. And he had said, look, I know everyone thinks, I'm just the back heel king. I will not do back heels. My father and I went to the preseason friendly. That was his debut. First two touches, back heels. Yeah. And you straight away, you're like, this isn't going to end well. And sure enough, it didn't.
There's some good stuff. We should maybe think about a football week. Oh, wait. John Berry, the pod has been a constant companion from Harvard Med to Pinehurst. Thanks. Can I selfishly ask for a birthday shout? Cheers. You can, John. There's
Happy
a
birthday.
Picture of the course he's playing. Harvard Med, Pinehurst.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Pinehurst. Hang on, which number
John
two?
Is living the life.
He doesn't say which number, John.
Pinehurst, that's...
He's going to own us all soon.
Yeah.
Doug Chisholm says, lads, love the pod, but could you adjust your level so voices don't go really quiet and then really loud? Hurts ears on headphones. We'll try in future, Doug. I make no promises for this particular podcast. Danny Fitzgerald had always assumed that the counting of the shots of the intro was Tiger slagging off Steve Williams. No.
It's Anthony Kim.
It's Kevin Na.
Oh, it's Kevin Na. Sorry.
You do that every time.
No, I don't. I've never done it. I literally have never done it before.
Someone does it every time. Could be me.
Yeah.
David Downey. Well, boys, love the pod. I'm just in Lanzarote sunning myself and looking forward to my wedding present of playing Royal County Down.
That's a nice wedding gift.
Living life there, David Downey. Someone replied to David saying, someone needs to tell this guy that Royal County Down ain't in Lanzarote.
Does he mean you, Joe?
That's the worst joke ever.
So well done, Snell77. Good shout from you. John Bailey says, hope all is good, lads. Yesterday was a touch better in Portrush than Castleknock weather-wise. I found a bunker in 17, so he's got a nice picture of him playing.
That's the giant bunker at Port Rush.
At Port Rush, yeah. Kendo was in touch, aka Big Vernon. I'm waiting for a bus home in Glasgow after a night whiskey tasting with my old man listening to the pod.
That's really little.
I want to know if his dad is at the bus stop while he has the headphones on listening to the pod.
Doesn't seem to be. Seems
dad,
to be.
Dad, I'm done with you.
He says, what are you doing, son? Seems to be, dad.
Seems to be a selfie, which I've literally just retweeted. There we go. Enda Kilgallen. Oh, interesting one.
Do you tweet me this?
Walking through town this morning, very hungover, but I still managed to shout friend of the pod to at Nathan Murph, hashtag friends.
Made my weekend.
Do you remember that?
Did you acknowledge him?
Just I was going down to my favourite Slovakian coffee joint on Saturday morning, and out of nowhere I hear somebody randomly shouting at me on the street. He did look a little bit hungover, it has to be said.
Excellent.
Made my day though.
I was coming through Dublin Airport last week, and the Garda who was checking at the immigration desk.
Did you tell
us
the story last week?
Yeah. I was coming through the
airport. You didn't tell us on air.
I wasn't here last week.
I know, but you told us in the office.
Yeah.
You didn't tell the listeners.
I'm telling the listeners now.
He thought you'd already told them, but I knew. Go on.
It's like working with something.
Amateurs. Yeah. He's an amateur. I knew what you were doing.
Yeah.
I was playing radio surprise with you.
So I'm coming through the airport last week.
Really?
And the... Jeez, Nathan. And the Garda who was testing the passport, he handed him the passport and he just looks up and he looks at my name and he went, oh, I love Golf Weekly. I love it. I walked out with a skip. This is brilliant.
Oh, that's good.
So to that Garda who, and I didn't get his name, thank you.
Shout out. Mm. And well done to Enda for shouting at Murphy in the street. Colin Fox, listening to the pod cycling on the Athlone Greenway. Not that glamorous, but sunny, peaceful and well-informed. Daniel says, he quotes us from last week, speaking of Bubba's pink balls he's playing with, this could potentially have been phrased differently, lads, he says. Lads, surely the run into the Masters is reason enough for two podcasts this week and next. Am I being overambitious?
Yes.
I would have thought so.
Well, usually you would be, but we're going to Port Accountant's House tomorrow.
That's true.
Bonus pod.
Yeah. Thanks for the great book tips, lads. Waiting for the next pod. Hurry up. And then, I like this. This was the last one. Martin Bradley. So, hi guys. Love time lover of the pod. I think he means long. Hi guys, love time lover of the pod. A bit of an unusual one. My colleague and friend is leaving work, who is also a friend of the pod. So he's leaving work on Friday. I'm really going to miss our Friday morning pod analysis, which sounds uber geeky, but we love that. It would be great if you could give a shout out to Mark McCarrigan.
Hey, Mark.
Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Best of luck wherever you're going next.
You could just WhatsApp each other now on a Friday morning.
Mark,
it's not
keep
the, same.
The relationship going.
It's not the same.
It's not, how many people who leave work do you ever talk to afterwards?
Never. Well, Joe never. Joe barely talks to people in work. Well, so
that's true. So Martin Bradley and Mark McCarrigan will no longer be able to do their pod analysis of a Friday morning.
Maybe Mark will leave your work but still turn up once a week to do another job there. What do you think about that, Fionn?
Impractical, but we'd like to see that happen. I mean,
like, just keep turning up.
Yeah.
Okay, we're talking, before we get to Neil Manship, we will talk Dustin Johnson next. So Dustin Johnson beat John Rahm in the WGC match play. That is three wins from his last three starts for Dustin Johnson. That's six wins, six trophies in 9 months. He's won both WGCs this year. 32 years old. Butch Harmon talking about him. Drives it great. He's like Tiger back in the day. Butch, obviously, his coach. He's a good putter. Not great, but good. He's learned to hit irons off tees, which I've been pushing for 7 years. He's a slow learner. And he has a 3-iron with a graphite shaft now that he hits miles. He really now has become the total package and nothing rattles him, that's for sure. That's a big plus. And interestingly, DJ has pulled out. He's withdrawn from the Shell Houston Open, which is on this week. So it leaves the Houston Open with four players ranked inside the world top 10. Jordan Spieth, Henrik Stenson, Adam Scott, Ricky Fowler, all playing. So Dustin Johnson is in the form of his life. If he could play the Masters tomorrow, you suspect he would.
He's joint favourite with Spieth for the Masters.
No favourite, by the way, has won the Masters since Tiger Woods in 2005.
Mm. No world number one has won the Masters since Tiger Woods in 2002.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He
Dustin Johnson against John Rahm. Dustin Johnson's weak. Awesome.
He was imperious. Oddly enough, his back nine on Sunday, he was one over. He was tired. He also holds all four WGCs now. So he's got like this WGC slam, which wasn't a thing and now apparently is a thing. It looked like he was going to crush Rahm. He was five up after eight. And then Rahm just started coming back. I think DJ kind of fumbled one hole, but Rahm just played out of his skin. He didn't make a birdie until 13 or 14, Rahm. And then all of a sudden just stretched into or ate into DJ's lead to the point that going down 18, he was only one down. And he drove through the green because he knew, obviously, he needed. And it looked like, I'm not going to say that DJ was going to crumble because DJ looked impervious. Like he looked like he was just going about his game. He looked very much as he always does. But Rahm had really put his foot on the gas. So he goes through the green, and just as he's about to, like, what, I'm not going to say it's a simple chip because under the phenomenal pressure that he was, but it wasn't the hardest chip in the world. It was more of a bump and run down the green. And just in his backswing, a portaloo door slams really loudly.
Yeah.
And Rahm, he kind of mishits the chip, so it ends up halfway down. Now, it must be said that he had to hit a point in the green and then he would let the ball dribble down and it would fall down. Now, it missed the point by about 2 feet, so it was really, really close to being perfect. And DJ, they half the hole and DJ wins by one. And Rahm, in the interview afterwards, what I thought was very interesting, what you'd expect a 22-year-old in his first year on tour, came so close to winning a WGC. When asked about the slamming door, might go, oh, you know, these things happen. I can only control the things I can control. It's disappointing, but you know what? I'll move on and I'm going to learn from this. He doesn't do that at all. And I think the sign of a truly ambitious and potentially great player, he just goes, it's really awful. He was really annoyed about it.
Yeah.
And he didn't blame anybody particularly, but he just said, look, when you've worked really, really hard to get to where you are, like, and he really did. He grinded so hard in that back nine. And to have something like that really upset his concentration is massively disappointing. And I thought, I must say, all credit to Rahm for being so brazen. Oddly, conversely then, when Wayne Grady is interviewing DJ. So DJ's his usual implacable self, you know. Hey, wedged it pretty good. And, you know, kind of just seemed like he's...
Implacable's a euphemism, but go on.
Yeah. And so... Wayne Grady's asked him a couple of questions about, you know, coming up to the Masters, you feel pretty good. And he goes, yeah, I just want to work on my mid-irons. He looks like he's just not really there.
No.
And then he goes, and Wayne Grady goes, what about a word for John? And the look on DJ is like, who? And Wayne Grady goes, Rahm. And he goes, oh. it was this beautiful moment where DJ then throws out this bromide, like, you know, it's like, you know, he's a really good player. I think he's going to be a great champion. But it's like, this is the guy you've just played match play for 18 holes with, like, who took you down to the 18th. It was a telling moment and a real indicator of the characters of both players.
I really wish his follow-up question was, tell me about the guy you beat earlier today in the semi-final.
Oh yeah, and that was another. Yeah, 36 holes on the day. That's brutal on what seems like a pretty tough course.
He did seem quite tired by the end of St. Johnstone, which maybe explains why he ended up beating Rahm and Tanihara both on 18. The 18th, yeah. But up to that, because on last week's pod we had seen him beat Webb Simpson and just crushed Webb Simpson, and he crushed everybody else over the next 3 days. Naren, Zach Johnson. Destroyed them.
Yeah. By the way, an interesting consequence of the new format, which we didn't mention last week, is that the Friday becomes full of dead rubber matches.
Oh, well, this year was worse than ever.
Really bad.
Yeah, it was a disaster because three, four players pulled out, which meant that there were a load of players who, though they had won their second match, as in Rory's situation, he didn't have a Kelson didn't have to play, which meant that no matter what Rory did on the final day, it was worthless.
Yeah, it actually really didn't work the Friday. It was terrible.
It was a non-event, I thought, until the final match. Mm. I thought the final was exciting and potentially would have been, again, another bore fest when DJ just wiped the floor with him in the back nine or the front nine. But that back nine was so exciting to watch.
Yeah.
Really, really good stuff.
Mention of Rory, he was making the point, you know, people said to him, so you now head to Augusta with 14 holes of competitive golf in 2017. He said he's not worried. Like he said, speaking to Sergio after the first day, if I played Sergio, I would have beaten him 6-5, whereas Søren Kjeldsen beat me 2-1, because obviously the quality of the match was excellent. And he said, the injury hasn't been ideal to start the year, but I've played the Houston Open before. I never felt like it did anything for me. I added it late before. I added San Antonio late before. It didn't really help me the following week. So I'd rather just go up to Augusta, play a couple of quiet practice rounds, and then prepare at home. So he's going to travel to Augusta on Sunday then. And that's where McIlroy is as he heads there. Dustin Johnson feels like the man to beat.
I don't think so.
I still can't get away from his putting.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we could easily look back after the Masters and go, how do we not see this happening? Because yeah. it seems he can win on any type of course.
Yeah.
He's joint favourite, rightly so. He's the hottest player in the world. He's number one. So he has everything going for him. But I'm with you, Nathan. I just don't think his putting is strong enough to win on those Augusta greens.
If I had to stake my life in it and take any player right now, it would still be Spieth, I think. Yeah. His record at Augusta is exceptional.
Yeah.
His greens and regulation stats have gone through the roof this season. Mm. That he's hitting it far closer, which means with his putting. Like, Rory definitely seems to be behind those two quite a bit right now.
Yeah. One point on Spieth. I just took a screen grab of the Golf Channel thing last night. So last year, his greens and regulation, he was 145th on tour. Terrible. He's number one this year. Number one. And proximity to hole, he was 91st last year. He's number five this year. Conversely, putting 15 to 20 feet, he was number two last year. He is 44th this year. And just putting generally, SG putting. What's SG putting?
Strokes gained.
Strokes gained putting, of course it is. Strokes gained putting. Last year, as well as being number two in 15 to 20 footers, in strokes gained putting overall, he was number two. This year, Jordan Spieth, strokes gained putting is number 35.
Mm.
So I'm not saying there's a crisis, I'm not saying there's an issue, but he literally has just flipped his game. Long game is now suddenly excellent, top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on tour, and putting has gone out to 35th, 44th. Now, maybe he gets to Augusta and he just turns it on and he can sharpen it very quickly.
I should say
he's had, you know, in seven events, he's had four top tens and one win.
He also might have had way more putts from 15 to 20 feet last year than he has done this year because his mid-irons are dialed in so much more.
Strokes gained generally from number two to 35.
Those stats were quite similar heading into his win this year. In fact, and I think his putting actually, his stats heading into the week he won were even worse than they are right now.
Right.
But his overall game, it improved to the extent that the second he got his putting back anywhere near where it was for the last couple of years, he easily won that tournament. Yeah. And you would expect that the greens on Augusta suit him down to the ground. Like, he is probably the best putter out there at Augusta.
And also statistically, you're looking, DJ's won his last three starts.
Yeah.
To win four starts in a row, like, Byron Nelson's done it.
Yeah.
Tiger Woods has done it.
Yeah.
And pick another.
It's an impossible thing to do, seemingly.
Yeah.
Like, Johnson, by winning, ironically, has almost ruled himself out. If he got knocked out on Saturday and got home and rested. I wonder, is this all set up for McIlroy? Like, he's been in really good shape. He's looked really good. It's just, you know, one or two missing pieces, the putting. Like, a shot of adrenaline, if he starts well. I'm just starting to wonder now if it's all set up for him.
We don't know, and golf punditry will put egg in your face faster than anything. So
no favorites since Tiger in 05. That's more than just a trend.
Yeah.
What about John Rahm? Fuzzy Zeller 79. Maybe this is the time.
Yeah, amen. I think John Rahm's obviously, he's an exceptional talent. Like, he really is. And also, he comes in. One of the things, to go back to the earlier point about his post round interview, was that the composure and that sense of his level of expectation is so cemented, it's so rock solid, that this is a guy, he isn't just grateful to be challenging on tour. This is a guy who's come to win.
Yeah.
So, you know, amateur, number one amateur in the world. Like, I don't know, it's like winning, first time winner at Augusta is like rarer than hen's teeth. So,
Yeah. So, we're going to keep things moving along because we've got to go out to practice range here, driving range here at the GUI. So up next, we have the national coach at the GUI. It's great to have him on. He's also obviously Shane Lowry's coach. It's Neil Manship, unless anyone wants to make any very massive final points. No. Okay, Neil Manship on the way. So So delighted to say we're here with Neil Manship, national coach here at the GUI, also Shane Lowry's coach, although I know he doesn't particularly love the word coach, which we can get on to. You've been here about 10 years at this stage, is that right?
Over since 2005 here.
Right. Am I right in saying you moved to Ireland initially at Royal County Down?
That's right. I came over with Kevin Whitson, who started at Royal County Down in 1992. So I came over with him, yeah, just after in the start of that year. Yeah, it's been great. Great then, to start off in a brilliant course like that at Royal County Down.
Yeah, and then it was on to Royal Dublin?
That's right, in 1999, moved down there with Leonard Owens as teaching professional down there, and was there until 2005 when I came over here.
Very good. And what about the playing side of things?
Not much these days. Lots of nine holes, one-day tournaments here and there during the summer when I'm at home. I'm back from tournaments, but not too much tournament play. Just plenty of golf with the national squads and play a lot with Shane when we're back home as well. And different not many tournaments.
Am I right in saying in 99, when you joined Royal Dublin, you won the Irish PGA Championship?
That's right. Yeah, I won the Irish PGA Championship that year. And as I sometimes tell to the lads, it was an interesting story from the outlook on the game, because I'd been trying really hard in the preceding years to get on tour and make some progress with my game, but I really wasn't getting too far. So I decided to give up, get a job somewhere, hopefully a teaching job somewhere or a club pro job somewhere. And then I moved down to Royal Dublin that year. And I think because I'd given up trying to play well, I was just enjoying playing. And I was still playing a lot of tournaments, a lot of pro-ams, and played really, really well that year. Mainly because I wasn't trying to play well, I was just playing.
I saw you say that. So that's, you know, the Irish PGA that you won in 99, Darren Clarke and Paul McGinley are in that tournament.
That's right.
So it's full of decent players, and you made the point that as soon as you started to try again...
Yes.
the bad downhill again, that's started. Right. So you have a really interesting insight into what pressure and really wanting to do well can do.
Yeah,
to
you
your
can see
game.
It a lot with some players when they get on the national squad for the first time. They've got there because their golf has been good in the previous year. So you really just want them to keep doing what they've been doing that got them there. And that was a case in point with me, that because I'd given up trying to do well, then I ended up playing much, much better. So sometimes, you know, trying to be better can make you worse. So the message a lot of the time for people that are struggling in that area is, look, you've got the skills already, just keep doing what you did in order to get you here.
Neil, I've seen you play, and I've heard your game described as a very elegant game. You're a lovely player to watch. So when you were trying to make it as a pro, and you talk about like the pressure of trying to play well, what part of your game was more susceptible, do you think, to that pressure?
I would think all parts of the game, really. It just wouldn't flow, and maybe it might manifest itself in putting sometimes. I even see it myself, even when I'm playing now, just trying too hard to make a good putt, rather than just pick a decent target and hit it at a decent pace. And you're always going to do really well when you do that, when you back off and just put your attention on your target, and specifically the weight of the putt you want to hit. So when I was playing badly, yeah, it was just trying to force things or trying not to hit bad shots, that kind of thing.
So you're head coach here at the GUI. How many kids are you interacting with, teenagers are you interacting with on an average month?
Well, under 16 squad, we have 12 players. Under 18 squad, another 12 players. On our development squad, which is a mixture of over 18s and under 18s, another 12 players. And then on the men's squad, on the senior squad, another 16 players.
Is there an age where you cut ties with the players who come through the GUI Academy? You mentioned the various paths they can go down as they get that little bit older. When they get to 18, 19... is that where they stop coming here, that they have to find their own path?
No, all areas are open. In terms of, if guys are on squads, they might be in the States and in college, but they could still be on one of our national squads. So we'd still be very much involved with them, helping them out in the summer, keeping in touch with them when they're away in the States. And even for the younger ones who want to go to university in the States, we can help them out a little bit with that. A lot of the US college coaches would be in touch with us quite frequently. So it's really just whether on the squads or not. We never cut ties with them. There's no age cut off. It's just if you're good enough to play, then you're the right age.
You know the way you'll often hear certain sayings about different countries, like South Africans are great bunker players, for instance.
Okay.
I don't know how true these things are.
Yeah, I've heard that a million times as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you hear that all the time. I was going to ask, is there a characteristic of Irish player? And I don't know, maybe there isn't, because you've a Harrington who was not a prodigious ball striker, and you've a McIlroy, and... so, you know, there's an obvious disparity there. But is there a characteristic or a real strength in Irish players that you see at underage level coming through? Or is it all different kinds of players?
All different. Yeah, like you say, I don't know where these stories come from. But even we were on the range in Texas last week, and it was really windy on the Thursday. And we were just saying that, how many times are we going to hear, oh, you Irish, you'll love this windy conditions. You just hear it every single time. It's as if the Irish guys love playing the terrible weather.
Yeah,
nothing could be further from the truth. But I think the characteristic would be that very strong at getting the ball around in challenging conditions, be it overhead conditions or a really tough golf course. Sometimes a weakness of ours generally, not specifically to individuals, but generally might be low scoring, because we tend, our championships tend to be set up on tough links courses. Mm. Sometimes we play in tough weather. So sometimes that may be a little bit of a weakness, but we can come up with games to get around that. Sometimes with our junior squads, we might play off the ladies' tees and just get into a mindset of shooting as low as you can. Just get used to shooting 7, 8, 9, 10 under par. It doesn't matter what the tees are you're playing off. It's really just a mindset to go really low in any tournament round of golf. Whereas if you're playing tough all the time, you just get used to level par is really good, or one over is really good, or one under is really good.
See, that's an Irish thing. Who do you think you are is what we'd say if someone shot 6 under.
Fluke.
The ego. The ego of you. It's out of control.
The tee was 10 yards forward under 4, so it doesn't count.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about the great Irish success we had 7-8 years ago, when we had a lot of players winning majors. We also had maybe the second tier players winning regularly on the PGA Tour, and it was said at that time that one of the reasons that the Irish golfers was so successful was because of the competitive nature of their upbringing, that they were playing really tough tournaments in Ireland, the west of Ireland, south of Ireland, these that maybe players around Europe didn't experience. That I was struck by the statistic recently that since Shane won at Baltrae, we haven't had a single player break into the top 200 of the world rankings. Is it that the rest of the world is caught up at underage level, or was it just a freak period where we had all these brilliant players coming together at the same time, or is it a case that maybe these young players just aren't as talented?
It was certainly plenty talented players, and if you look at all the players you mentioned, they're all at different stages of their careers, where Rory was just starting off some really prolific wins, and no doubt he's got a lot more in him. Harrington and Clark and Graham McDowell, a little bit younger again, at different stage of his career, winning the US Open back in 2010. So, no, I mean, it was just a lot of good players having great results all at the same time. But like you say, we've got really strong championships here. We've got a great environment for golf in Ireland and great accessibility to golf clubs around the country, playing loads of different conditions, and the championship setup is really, really good. And added on to that, then we have a really good international program for our top players. So there is a great environment for players to get the best out of themselves and play an international competition along with our good domestic circuit. But it doesn't mean that we're always going to get great results that we had in that period that you talk about.
Listeners will want to know, what do you look for in a swing? What are the most important things when you're watching a swing for the first time? What draws your eye? What are you looking out for?
Well, in the swing, not much. But if we're talking about swing, just good rhythm and good repeatability. So really what we're talking about is consistency of ball flight and selection of ball flight, and really predictability over the distance and direction that they hit the ball. Mm. So any good player is going to have very predictable distances throughout his wedge game, iron play, and good off the tee. I mean, you can either be long and slightly inaccurate off the tee, or you can be short to medium and straight. Short and offline isn't going to get you very far.
Yeah.
And if you're long and straight like some of the guys on the tour, then fantastic. But really overall in the game, just players understanding the distance to hit the ball. So if they can get pin high with their wedges, if they can get pin high with their approach play, and they can be pretty good off the tee and hole some putts, and they're going to do really well.
And what are the biggest failings you might see in a standard amateur who's listening to this and playing in their local monthly medal?
A lot of the time, distance control. Players tend to do their distances off the best shot they've ever hit, and that's how far I hit an 8-iron, or that's how far I hit a 6-iron.
So true.
And what we'd always encourage young guys to do is just keep a track of how relative they are to pin high. So in each round of golf, they keep a little chart of, I was 3 yards short of pin high in the first, I was 10 yards long of pin high in the second, and just really keep an accurate distance of how. So it really helps in their club selection, where they're trying to force an 8-iron into the wind and it's going to balloon up, or just hit a smooth 7, much easier to get pin high. Because when we're playing golf, we can always see the direction of the shot immediately. As soon as we've hit it, we know if it's left or right, but we don't know how the distance is going to be until it finishes. Mm. So distance control and putting, pace and putting, distance control and iron play is something that we put a lot of attention on.
Because really, if you're going to be the opposite attitude, that I'm going to slightly duff it and it's going to come up 20 yards short of where I actually want to hit it.
He takes a 3-wood from about 180.
Okay, nice smooth one though.
Why not just a nice little half swing?
Little cut up
I
one.
I think it's a half swing. It's
a love tap.
Yeah.
I like the player who thins a 6-iron and goes, pured that one.
Yeah, it goes a bit further when you thin it, so they like that. Yeah.
Most amateurs, it seems, I have an untrained eye clearly compared to you, but try and swing too hard or off balance.
Yeah.
It's one of the things you'd probably see most commonly.
Yeah, that's right. You often see players who look at what somebody else has hit from the tee, be it a par three, that guy's hit a six. I think it's a five for me, but I better just hit a six. I don't want to look bad.
Yeah. You're out on tour, obviously, a little bit with Shane, and you're seeing the guys in the driving range. Who grabs your eye? Who do you like to spend watching for that extra 5 minutes?
Oh, I really wouldn't watch anybody. I was waiting for Shane. He was doing an interview the other day, and I was watching Phil Mickelson hit some shots. And it was just, he's always good to watch. You know, you can just see he just loves playing the game and loves hitting shots. And he was just hitting a few. It was really windy that day, and he was hitting some low six irons into the target was about 140, 150 yards away, but it was straight into a really strong wind. And it's just great to watch somebody like him. You can see even at, just a bit older than me, I think, but he just loves playing tournament golf, and he just loves the whole thing. So watching somebody like him is just watching a kid who's out there for the first time, just really loving it.
I know you work tactically with a lot of the players as well, because they may have their own Michael Bannon coach. So tactics and course management is one of the things you'll really talk to them about. Can you talk to us about that area? Maybe give us examples of the pro players who you think manage a course really well. What are the common pitfalls, mistakes?
I always remember, I think Paul McGinley won at Valderrama a few years ago. I can't remember when it was, but I just remember reading an interview he did after it, and I think he was staying with Eddie Jordan that week, and Eddie Jordan was just talking about how a racing driver would navigate his way around a track and where to accelerate and decelerate and whatever suited him and his car and his tires. So he was talking about how to play Valderrama like that and really negotiate yourself around it very smartly. It just really stuck with me that back then tactical play, especially in a course like Valderrama, where you have to be so smart about where you hit the ball to and the positions you hit it off the tee. And it's just always stuck with that kind of analogy with a racing driver of really thinking about how you want to position the car or the ball around the course.
Your role here is very much your full-time role, and your work with Shane is not, I don't want to use the word secondary, but it's more part-time than your day-to-day role here. Is that right?
Yeah, we have a lot of autumn, winter, spring, we'd have a lot of weekend squad sessions here with the various squads, under 16s, under 18s development. Then we travel overseas a fair bit with the men's squad. They're off in Sota Grande, Spain this week playing the European Nations Cup. And then I would travel to Shane with the certain tournaments during the year that we earmark that's important to be at, some major championships and some other tournaments as well. So yeah, they tend to work well alongside each other.
When did you first see him play?
2005 at the Island Golf Club, a boys trial, under 18 boys trial. And yeah, it was obvious right away. He'd been talking about Talent ID. He wasn't on the squad at the time, but somebody from the area had recommended that he should be looked at, so he was invited along for the day, and I think he finished second in that tournament. But right away you could see he was a very good player.
Right.
What was it about it? Like, I mean, I know he has this world-class short game, maybe one of the best three players in the world, but was there anything else that you look and you went, wow, that's an exceptional...
No, I think like you were talking about earlier on, just the overall game, just the way about his business, you could see he was very serious about what he was doing. Good all-round game, good putter, good driver of the ball, good iron player, and he shot a couple of good scores that weekend that we had. So yeah, again, it was just good all-round.
Do you that day think, wow, this potential WGC winner?
That's exactly what went through my mind.
You know, because it's such a leap, you know.
It should be about 2015, I reckon.
It's such a leap to think that about any kid that you're seeing that age. Has he surprised you? Has he surprised you, I guess, is the question.
You know, yes. I'm definitely progressed from... I mean, winning the Irish Open as an amateur was just incredible, wasn't it? For anybody to do that, especially in the circumstances in which he did it, with a fantastic 10-under par second round on the Friday, and then the horrendous conditions on the Sunday and the three playoff holes and all that was going on with that and the terrible rain. So for any amateur to win their European Tour event, their home European Tour event, was just amazing. So you could use that as a benchmark and say, well, look, he's done it already. So obviously in the professional game, he could do really good things. But you never know how it's going to go. You never know how people are going to cope with the professional tour life, all the travelling. The better that you do, the more expectations people have of you and you have of yourself, and people go up and people go down, and sometimes guys succeed right away, sometimes it takes other players quite a few years. Look at Seamus Power now, doing so well in the PGA Tour. He's exactly the same age as Shane. They played boys golf together. You know, Shane won the Irish Open, and Seamus has been playing many tours in the States and progressed to the web.com tour and done extremely well. So people progress at different times, and you just never know. People are going to hang in there, people are going to give up and do something else, so you just never know.
Who do you have on hand then to speak to those 18, 19 year olds who are thinking about getting into that pro game, and it might be challenge tour where it's even tougher than the pro circuit, and they're staying in cheap hotels, everything's not handed them on the plate anymore? Do you bring Shane and the former players back to speak to them to give them that little bit of advice?
Yeah, Shane's very good like that, and other players are too. Paul McGinley was with us last year for a big seminar with all of the players from the underage groups onwards upwards, and Shane has been over, and other pros too. Paul Dunn will be with us in the next few months as well to do. He's offered to do a clinic with the guys and talk to the players as well. So all of the players are very good at giving up their time, and Porrick Harrington does a couple of times as well. So yeah, they can offer advice on their journey and what they've seen and mistakes they've seen other people do. I always remember Paul McGinley talking about he's never seen players fail from... He's seen a lot of players fail from trying too hard, whether it be with their swing, whether it be in the gym or other things, changing equipment too much. He's never seen talented players fail from the other end, from being... Some people might call it being lazy, but really it's just them being themselves and just doing the simple things and getting on with their own game. So that was a strong message for young guys who get a lot of equipment thrown at them, a lot of advice thrown at them, lots of stuff here, there, and everybody telling them what to do and how to do it. And you should do it like this player, and you should be like Jordan Spieth, and you should be like this, or you should be like that. And it was very easy for people to lose themselves and lose the ability that got them there in the first place, why they're there having that conversation in the first place. So the message is often, look, just keep being yourself, go on your own track. You'll make some mistakes as you go along. Nobody knows the exact route to go along. You've just got to find it out for yourself and see how you go.
Shane would always speak about your relationship in a hugely complimentary way. You're a part-time psychologist as well as talking about the swing, and you've had chats with him in locker rooms, which he's found hugely beneficial, and you obviously see that as part of your role and being a sounding board for him. What's your perspective on the player coach relationship? I know you don't describe it necessarily as you're just his coach.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a psychologist for a start, but look, I've been there before. We all play golf. We know how frustrating it can be sometimes, and we know the experiences we've had when we've been trying to force things or trying too hard, or other times when we've just been playing quite casually without too much effort, and well, we played really fantastically today. I wonder why that was. Yeah. It's hard to explain sometimes, but yeah, we've known each other for a long time. Like I said earlier, I just started as national coach in 2005 when Shane got on his first squad. So we've kind of shared a bit of a journey together in terms of progress that way, and I think we enjoy each other's company, and there's a lot of tough times along the way, a lot of disappointments and a lot of great times as well, but hopefully I can be there to support him, not always giving him the right advice, but doing my best to do what I can do and help him out in some difficult situations. But he's an extremely talented player. He's got a lot more to get out of himself. Sometimes things are difficult, but there's a lot of fantastic times along the way as well.
Would you guys be making changes, big or small, to his swing on a regular basis?
Not really. No, at this stage, you know, you've pretty much got it.
Right.
And certainly with somebody like Shane, who's got fantastic rhythm, you know, swinging the club very well, ball flights are very good, the driving's going very well at the moment. So all around, just keeping the whole game ticking over, and just him, as long as he's doing what he thinks he's doing, then on a really good track, as long as there's no glaring errors between I feel like I'm doing this but I'm actually doing that, then you're going to be pretty much on track.
Right.
It's interesting you mentioned McGinley's advice to the younger players to basically just be yourself
and
continue on that path.
Yeah.
Because when Shane went professional, I can't think of too many more Irish sports people that everybody seemed to have advice from. Everybody seemed to know what would be best for him as he went on, that if he changed his fitness regime, suddenly he'd become a far better golfer. And like that pressure, I'm sure, must have been getting to him at some stage. Was that the moment where you had to give him that bit of advice and step in and say, we're on the right path, we feel we're doing things right, we don't need to change that much?
But he always was working on his fitness from quite a young age. For whatever reason, you know, he wouldn't advertise it that much, so maybe people thought that he wasn't doing anything. But he's always been doing it on and off, not all the time, but usually he's got something going on and had different trainers over the years. And at the moment he works with Robbie Cannon, who works with our national squads as well. And he puts a hell of a lot of work into his fitness. On other areas as well, anyone in the limelight, they're there to be advice given. We all like watching our footballers or rugby players. We've all got an opinion of who should be doing what. So it's no different to that, really, is it? It's part of just dealing with being a successful professional. And for the guys who are not in the limelight, they're not getting much of that because they're not up there. But as soon as you're put in there, you've just got to learn to live with all these different opinions coming in and just take them as they are and keep being yourself.
He seems to have done it very well. Maybe just a final point or two, because you've been very good with your time. The Augusta experience, it's on our bucket list to get there. Have you
No.
No. You've driven by it.
Yeah. I've driven by the front. Augusta.
And asked to move on by
two
the
two more contrasting experiences. Augusta, the town, and Augusta, the golf course. Yeah, I've experienced great. Augusta, the town. Not that keen to go back.
Maybe Augusta, the town, is a bit nicer when you're actually allowed into Augusta,
yeah, when you know
course.
That you're going in up Magnolia Lane.
I think it's an unfair comparison because, I mean, everything is so ridiculously sort of perfect and pristine. I mean, it's an amazing place, the golf course. It really is. The condition of it.
Was it your first time there last year?
The year before.
The year before.
Yeah,
so
I've been there twice.
You're a golf nerd. You love the history. You know every hole off by heart. You know the house, the clubhouse, Magnolia Lane. Going with all that knowledge, then, so does the reality live up to what you hope it will be?
Oh, way above it, I think. When you see the condition of it up close, it's just amazing how perfect everything is. And even people have talked about before the difference in the way that the course can play from before the tournament kicks off in the practice rounds, when it can be, greens can be quite receptive and players can be hitting shots in 6 irons, 5 irons, quite receptive.
McIlroy
just changed the course like that.
McIlroy said that recently. He said practice rounds are almost a waste of time. Almost a waste of time because they change the greens so much.
That's right. They can really change the course so quickly. But I mean, the greens are just, the surface on them are just absolutely perfect. The fairways are just amazing. It's just the most beautiful place. It really is. Yeah.
And is it because, obviously, as a fan, if I ever get a chance to actually go up Magnolia Lane and see it, I'll be amazed and I'll be wowed, no matter how critical I can be about Augusta history. But for players who have spent, you know, all these years kind of in tempered in the steel of competitive golf, and like, are they, when they arrive for the first time, are they as awed by the experience of being there as, say, your typical fan?
Yeah, you never see players there. I mean, I've only been there twice, but some, speaking of limited experience, but you never, certainly I've never heard anybody say, you know, same old, or
everyone. Yeah, it's all right. It's not nice trees.
It's all right. I've been here before, but it's just, I think it's just this, the overall vista of the place when you drive up Magnolia Lane, the clubhouse right in front of you there, and into the car park and out into the course. It's so pretty to look at, the flowers in full bloom. And like you say about the history of the place, you're so used to watching all the holes on TV and the effect the wind has them. You go down the really, how steep the hill is down the 10th, the really, really difficult 11th. And then when you walk down the 11th fairway, you'll often see the 11th and 12th run parallel to each other. And the flag on the 11th might be blown to the left, the flag on the 12th might be blown to the right. So you just know when you get on that 12th tee that it's complete lottery about what club to hit. But yeah, beautiful place, and really look forward to going back.
It's been really great to spend some time with you, Neil Manship, a national coach at the GUI. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, lads.
There you go. Great to have Neil Manship on. A touch of the, you know, when he's talking there about the more he cared and the more he tried, the worse he got. Dustin Johnson seems to have that whole not giving a damn, zero increase in his heartbeat thing down, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And it seems very much like he's, like I'd say, I mean, I don't know what Neil, but if Neil had ever to sit to DJ, he'd go, wow, you really got it figured out, because he wins and loses like he doesn't care. Just on the matter of, I thought I'd let you guys know. I know we were talking about Augusta and how beautiful, and Neil was talking about that hill on 10.
Yeah.
So I'm just about to join this new golf course near enough to where I live in Manchester called Reddish Vale. And it's a lovely golf course, old golf course, but it's designed by Alistair McKenzie, who also is really the main designer of Augusta. And so this is a guy who would have been like, you know, designed loads of courses in England and Scotland, then moved to America and became like one of the golf designers in America. So I feel like I'm playing in a kind of an Augusta course. But one of the things that the 18th, I must...
Right, good for you, buddy.
You know, I'm telling you.
So, you keep telling yourself that.
The
What's 18th, the name of this course again?
Reddish Vale. The 18th...
Sounds like a cheese.
So why did you turn your back in Titherington?
Titherington is too far away. And but the 18th...
He never really settled in. They didn't take to him.
No, they didn't. They didn't like my... I have a mercurial personality. I don't know. It was like my constant chatter on the golf course. Just, you know. No, it was too far away.
Okay.
And this one's just like 5 minutes from my house.
Well, good luck at Reddish Vale.
Thanks very much, Joe. And
the Augusta of the wider Manchester area.
Yes. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
The hill on 18. So I played
Is it reminiscent of another course that has an 18th with a hill?
No, reminiscent of the hill at 10 at Augusta.
So it's like downhill.
No, but this time you're walking uphill.
Well, that's the 18th at Augusta.
Oh, no, but this is like Like,
no, that's the 18th of Augusta.
My trolley, yeah. You had to push my trolley, nearly killed me.
You can't see the 18th of Augusta. Can't even see the green.
Shocking.
You wouldn't understand. Well, I mean, I don't know how I understand because I haven't been there either. Yeah. But I've heard.
Yeah.
The 18th,
yeah.
When you're at the bottom of that hill on the 18th of Augusta, you're barely seeing a flag fluttering.
Okay, well, it's very similar.
I mean, it's.
Yeah. I didn't realize that it was so steep on 18. Because when you look at it on television.
I'd wonder where he got his inspiration for the 18th of Augusta.
The mountain.
Have you played there yet?
At Augusta?
No.
No, I played British Vale the other day.
All right. And yeah. there's no plaque on the side of 18 saying the 18th at Augusta replica. Is modelled on this hole.
It's not a dogleg right by any chance, is it?
No.
Right, okay.
No. But really,
he learned from his mistakes.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Anyway, but it's a hilly course. Very nice. I mean, it's not fancy. It's like, you know, I could tell you right now, it's like, it's really affordable.
Okay. Good. We're going to go out and we may bring you some tips in the next couple of weeks, which we will record with Kenny if we've time. And we're going to play the O'Meara course. They've asked us. Not that they've asked us. They've allowed us.
They've asked us. Please play the O'Meara course.
Are you going to play? Because like, there was a very embarrassing incident when we arrived in. And like, Carton House and the GUI invited us out to play their course.
Wall, where I just said, can we play the Monty course?
Play their course. And so they said, you're going to play the O'Meara course. And Fionn, with the look of pure disgust, goes, is the Monty not open?
Terrible moment. It's like, and
wow.
Alan here went to the trouble of, he's like, I'm sorry, you'll just have to make do with your,
if you
free,
don't ask,
your free golf on the O'Meara course.
If you
course.
Don't ask, you don't get.
You're also the first person in history who's had that reaction to being told they're getting the O'Meara instead of the Monty.
Oh no, I like the O'Meara course and I've played it a few great, times yeah. in the last year.
You like the bunkers on Monty.
I like the Monty.
You're a
course.
Precision player.
Yeah, I like.
Listen, as you told the room.
Yeah, Neil well, Manship's there looking at going, is this well, guy messing or not?
Yes.
You said it so deadpan.
Razor's edge humor, my friend.
I mean, I was with you, but I think Neil Manship was like, how good is this guy?
Yeah, pretty good.
Okay, so that's what we're off to do. So we might bring you some tips in the next couple of weeks and we'll have a Masters preview and all that jazz. Good luck. Oh,